Hello, I'm Mark Steiner, and welcome to another one of our Urbanite Radio stories. In this month's August issue of the Urbanite, Michelle Gleneau wrote an article called Making It, A Hardy Crew of Food Fanatics Takes a Do-It-Your-Own to a New Level. Well, we'll find out what that means and what Baltimore food makers are. We have in the studio with us Hillary Edwards, who's Assistant Director of Wellness and Academic Life Balance at the University of Maryland, Baltimore, and Brian Murphy, who is a member of the Food Makers Group here in Baltimore, is featured in the article. And folks, welcome. Good to have you both here.
Thank you for having us.
Thanks for having me.
So it's just the way the article made it sound is like this: the Food Makers is taking this do-it-yourself thing to another level here in Baltimore in this sustainable movement. I guess you helped. Who was at the beginning? Were we both at the beginning of this group? You were.
Brian.
I should say Joanna Bachman, who was supposed to be here today, couldn't make it, unfortunately. She was the original founder of the group. I came on maybe 6 to 8 months after it started, so maybe it's about 2 years old. But Joanna was the founder and first brought together the group, and since then she's kind of handed it over to me to run it, but she's still pretty actively involved.
So tell me, what is it?
So,
why don't you describe to our listeners what it is we're talking about?
Sure. So Food Makers is a group of people in Baltimore, very informal group of people, and it's all different type of people, but they all have some connection via food, some connection to making food in some way, and I mean that in the very general sense of the word, making it. So whether they're growing it or cooking it or preserving it or just eating it, but that whole kind of cycle of making food and then the connections that are involved with that. So, you know, we have people in the group who are professional chefs. We have stay-at-home moms who are making baby food. We have people who are just farmers, and they're just selling stuff. So it's kind of everyone involved in
making food. So what's the idea of the group? What is it supposed to, what brings people together? What's the commonality? What do people do?
I think the commonality is a desire to have a deeper connection with where their food comes from. Obviously, we're all eating food, so there's nothing unique about that. And probably all of us, I mean, all of us in some level go home and probably cook some type of dinner. So we all have a little bit of that in us. And I don't want to in any way sound like we are that unusual, because like we all do make food. But I think the people in the group have a respect and appreciation for really where exactly their food's coming from, either knowing the person that made it or making it themselves, growing their own vegetables, or having, you know, preserved some jam back in the summertime so they can have it in the winter. I think everyone in the group, I guess, you know, to answer your question, that connection is the commonality is some desire to have that intimate knowledge of where the origins of your food are, and then the fun that's involved with that, and the interest in learning something new and maybe learning something that everyone knew at one time but maybe isn't as well known now.
Are you in this group, Hillary?
Yes.
You are in the group.
Mm-hmm.
So why are you in the group? I mean, what drove you to the group or attracted you to the group?
Well, I've been involved for most of my life in terms of local sourcing of food. I grew up in the restaurant business in Washington, D.C., and I've always had the privilege to have access to fresh and local food. You know, every week we'd go to the farmer's market growing up. And then I came to Baltimore for college and then wanted to continue because I realized there were so many places in an urban environment where people were disconnected to food. It doesn't necessarily matter what your income level is or what your job is or where you're necessarily located. But one of the biggest disconnects that happened in the latter half of the 20th century was this industrialization of food. So people became further and further and further from where they got food, whether there were no small corner bakeries anymore. There was no charcuteries or things like that. It's like you'd go to the mega grocery store.
What was
the last
word you
just
said?
Like meat, just like a meat store.
Meat store, right. Mm-hmm.
You know, just getting your fresh produce. It's all in one sort of mega mart that was known as a grocery store. And so I think I had the privilege to be able to go to a farmer or go to a baker, and my mom's a baker as well, and get that. But a lot of people didn't have that sort of intimate relationship with food. And I felt coming out of college, that was something that I really wanted to help provide in some way through my work on a grassroots level and also as on an institutional level.
Mm-hmm.
Because I think there needs to be a dialogue between them both or between the two of them. Because if you have both supporting more like do-it-yourself fresh produce and local food, then that's sort of where, you know, people can make a lifestyle out of it. And I think that's where Food Makers really comes in, because you have so many people from so many different parts of the city trying to be involved in making or giving other people access to fresh food or tips on how to find it.
So what? Tell me what happens in the typical meetings of a food makers. What do you do together?
So I don't want to make this sound like this is something we're getting together every day. Basically, there's an online forum where kind of people post discussions throughout the month. Mm-hmm. And that's kind of that's the bulk of the interactions, I guess, in terms of, you know, the number of times and conversations. But then once a month, we get together, have a potluck, and we're trying to get together more often than that, slowly. But right now, we've always had a monthly potluck. Basically, people bring some type of dish, and there's usually some type of theme, and and so people come together for an evening, you know, share food, enjoy the food, talk about what's in it, how they made it, and learn from others, and it's always very interesting food. I think people like to be creative for these, and so they'll. They might bring something slightly unusual, or it might just be something they grew that they're really proud of, you know, some really delicious tomatoes or something.
And like that. What's interesting, this is a group that's a kind of a combination of carnivores, omnivores, herbivores of all kinds,
definitely,
vegans.
Definitely.
You're not a vegan, I take it. I'm saying you cure meat.
No, I'm not a vegan, although I was a vegan actually for about 2 years of my life. So I've kind of gone the full spectrum. I did my time eating nothing but, you know, lentils and beans and rice and things like that. And I do eat meat now. And yes, true, I do some home curing of meat. But that being said, I'm very particular about where my meat comes from. And any meat I buy comes from, you know, local farmers in Maryland, and I have, you know, close relationships with individual farms. And so so I don't want to say I've completely swung back to the other side, not in the slightest. But I guess I would say maybe I'm a particular omnivore.
And what about you?
I also ran through the vegan stage, but in the same thing. I think one of the big things that I learned at that time was how much processing went into
everything
pretty much that you find in a grocery store. I think less than 1% of the grocery store is really salvageable.
1% of the grocery store is salvageable? 1%?
Yes. Less, yeah.
What do you mean by that?
Well, in terms of thinking of sustainability or looking at local sourcing, most of the produce, even if you're going to a place like Whole Foods, mm-hmm. it's all shipped from all over the country. Mm-hmm. In all of those middle aisles, it's all preserved with some type of corn syrup. And then, you know, the back where you'd have like the dairy or eggs, they come from major factory farms. So it's really, when you look at the ingredients list on food labels, there's most of them have like at least 10 ingredients. And that's 10 ingredients that don't necessarily or should not exist in those types of foods. So when I was vegan and I would have to look at every single label at the grocery store, it made me realize how much was in everything. And it made me want to be really simple in terms of my food choices. And so coming out of a vegan diet and looking at foods that were unprocessed, and a lot of times when people are vegan, they'll go for, soy yogurt or soy meat, and that's still processed. So it was looking at finding a balance in real food. And I think so while I ran the gambit of that, but, you know, again, local sourcing, looking, you know, local farms that do support, you know, chickens that have maybe one bad day in their life.
It's hard to get around that one bad day.
Yeah, it's hard to get around the one bad day. But, I think it's really, I think Baltimore is a really great place to, even if you're not vegan or if you haven't really been that conscious of those food decisions, it's a great place to start learning about it, because I think we have access to such amazing and humble people who are really interested in helping to educate the rest of the community.
It's interesting. So people come together in this group because you are interested in doing your own cooking, finding the right food that's locally sourced, and whatever you do. So it becomes like from the kitchen out, from the farm to the kitchen to your table, and try to do things in a more, for want of a better term, natural way, a non-industrial way.
Yeah. Sure, definitely.
So you said that people who are in this group run the gamut of diets and kinds of people and demographic in this community. So someone said to me at a conversation a few weeks back with somebody who's doing a documentary on local restaurants, local chefs who try to buy their food locally and talking to local farmers and people who own wineries. And one of the things, though, he said was that as much as those he called purists, he might call you all purists. I don't think you're purists so much, but I mean that we will never, can never get to a place where all of our food is made in an artisanal way by small farmers that is local. We just don't live that way anymore, and that without some large production and shipping, we're not going to survive as a population of 300 million people. It's just impossible to do.
So I've definitely heard that argument before. And
do you agree or disagree with that argument?
I appreciate that argument. How about that?
Okay.
I definitely appreciate that, and I've often wondered, just in particular, I don't know off the top of my head, you know, if you said, look at the farmland in Maryland, what population size could Maryland farmland in itself support? I don't know the answer to that. And I think, so I understand the argument. I guess I look at it as if you step back and you say there's no way to support our society right now on local food, that gives me pause, I guess. It tells me that have we gone down, you know, a bad path or a wrong direction? And so maybe, you know, maybe it's true what he's saying, but I guess I don't think then that the answer is just that you say, okay, well, we've passed that point. We can never go back to having a local economies again. We have to do things on this large mass industrial scale. I don't really see that as an acceptable answer, I guess. I realize there is a lot of people we have to fit in this world. But I would like to think that there is a much bigger middle ground, that we could get much closer to something where, you know, for example, you know, maybe most of your produce comes from local sources, but your calorie crops, you know, your grains, your beans, your potatoes, things like that, those are maybe coming from further away. But even that, you know, I'd still like to see, you know, maybe a diversified, you know, you get some of all of your food locally, and maybe some of it comes from further away. I think there has to be a middle ground there. It concerns me if we can never go back, if we can never go back to knowing the baker and knowing the butcher.
Hello, what do you think? I have some thoughts about that.
I respect that argument as well. One of my concerns is, you know, if we can't sustain ourselves locally, I still don't think that we can sustain ourselves on these large, vast monocultures that are across the Midwest of corn or rice, like, or in California where you have acres upon acres of lettuce. I don't think those are ways that you farm. I don't think those are ways that in 10 years down the line that soil will have the nutrients to be able to sustain healthy food. And so I think that's a big issue, is I think if we're going to address, you know, we can't sustain ourselves on a local level, well, we still have to look at those large industrial systems and see, well, can we change those systems as well to be able to sustain themselves? Like, you know, large mass acres of land that's used for farming, a lot of it's used for the same thing. And that lack of diversity, I don't think is sustainable in the long term. So I think that you have to recognize that there are errors in that thinking as well.
Let me ask you two questions about this. I'm curious. I mean, I do want to come back. I know we want to talk some about the food you all make and what you share in this place, which I think is important. I want to come around our way back to that and where you get your food. I say what I'm saying, and these questions I'm asking you is someone who is very picky about where I get my food.
Okay.
So I'm one of those picky – I've grown into a picky one. But – as I tell my youngest daughter, Maisie, who this summer declared herself a pescatarian and changed our diet in many ways in the house for the summer, that, you know, you also have to be an opportunarian. And when you go to someone's home, you don't ask where they got their food. You eat what they put on the table. So when we go visit the Rez in Wyoming and our friends on the Indian reservation come up and put down that elk, you're going to eat it.
Definitely.
So, yeah.
I didn't say it in an order way, but I'm saying we eat it because that's what they serve us. So, I mean, having said that, that we don't live just by local food anymore. I mean, we eat oranges. Do you eat oranges in the winter?
I normally don't.
You don't? Do you eat oranges in the winter?
Not too much. Citrus.
Interesting.
Citrus
okay.
is, you know, I'll have some citrus in the winter as my kind of main fruit because it is, if you're going to at least have a seasonal fruit, it's the seasonal fruit. If you're getting it from Florida or something like that, obviously it's not local. But
yeah,
but
where else will you get it from? California or Florida or some other place?
But
right?
No, actually, I don't. I don't actually. I stopped buying orange juice, and it's rare that I buy a pineapple anymore because you're just not going to find one around here.
Very interesting. And you the same?
Yeah, I mean, I lived abroad in Costa Rica for the first half of 2009, where I did a tour of the Dole pineapple plantation and the banana plantation, and I, you know, came back to the U.S. and was like, I can't support these non-seasonal.
Well, tell me what happened to you in those two places. What happened to you in the banana plantation and the pineapple plantation?
I think, well, it was a tour. I mean, they would give tours, mm-hmm. and they would. One of the interesting things I felt with the pineapple plantation specifically is they had the same pineapple but three different labels: the generic label, the organic label, and then the European label. But they were all the same. And so that's a question of, you know, when you see the labels like organic or cage-free, if that's really meaning, you know, that it was raised ethically.
You're telling me the pineapples that you see stamped at Wegmans or Giant or wherever you buy them and they're stamped with organic, that they're sprayed as much as the other ones are sprayed?
Yes.
All right.
I mean, I saw it with my own eyes.
No, I believe you. I'm just asking a question.
But it's something, you know, I think it put a lot in perspective in terms of seasonality. And I think that I can, you know, the generations before me lived without pineapples or oranges during the winter. And I think I can as well and still have a very nutrient-filled diet.
And put it this way, I mean, think about when you finally do visit Costa Rica and you get to have a pineapple and you haven't
it's
eaten a pineapple.
It's the most amazing thing in the entire world.
In a year or two. It's
mangoes are the most amazing thing in the I can't have a mango or an avocado anymore either because it's not fresh. It's not picked right there in front of me.
So you'll only eat fresh?
I mean, I can't say I'm 100% because there will always be errors.
Right.
For the most part, I try the best I can. And that's really all that I think any of us could ever ask is that we just try the best we can and what we believe is personally
mm-hmm.
right.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of choices. But it's interesting. It makes traveling that much more fun. I mean, I mentioned that, you know, go to Costa Rica, you have the fruit down there. You know, now you can go to a supermarket and basically buy food from any country. And don't get me wrong, I still, you know, there's still wonderful olive oil from Italy that's in my pantry and things like that. So I will not at all say I am, 100% pure and not a hypocrite in the slightest. No, but I think just, you know, if there's something that you can't get unless it's, you know, specially flown from the other side of the world, I just think twice about, is that a mainstay of my diet, you know?
And I'm asking these questions because I think challenging this idea is important just because to come out of our comfort zone a little bit. I mean, if you think about those, again, of us who like to eat locally, as local as much as possible, I do buy bananas and I do buy pineapples in the winter.
My roommates, they're in my house all the time. But
those who attempt to buy our food locally, the cost of local food is often far greater than the cost of food that is shipped in because it's done in volume in a mass way. And so it also becomes, I think, a class issue in the society about what you can afford and what you can't afford to eat.
You know, I've heard that many times that this is kind of, the hippie elitist, oh, you know, I'm going to be so picky and only. And it's true, the price tag that you see in the store or the price tag you pay on the farm is more expensive. But you say the cost is more expensive. And I think if you step back and you look at the cost to society, I think there's a lot of other things that you don't see in the price tag that are wrapped up in the cost. And so, you know, while your local, let's say, meat, let's take me for example, your local beef that you buy mm-hmm. from the farmer who let it grass, you know, it's grass-fed beef, obviously it's more expensive. And so if you go by the store and you go to buy your corn-fed beef, it's much cheaper. But what you don't see wrapped up in that is the massive pollution that's running downriver from the factory farm out in the Midwest, the feedlot where all the cows are crammed together. Or what you don't see that's wrapped up in the cost, the cost that's not in the label, is the all the bacteria, the antibiotic-resistant bacteria that regenerate on that feedlot. And so it's kind of like there's almost this this delayed cost that's accruing to our society that, you know, one of these days that cost is going to come back.
I also think a major, and that's an argument that's been happening for years. And I think one of the things that why I prefer seasonality and why I'm so adamant about my myself buying local food is because it's more satiating. I think one of the things, especially with beef, like grass-fed beef has a very different flavor, and you can eat a lot less of it because it's more filling on in a smaller quantity versus corn-fed beef, which doesn't necessarily have that same satiating value. It has more fat in it, and so you will eat a larger portion of that, and you get a larger portion for a cheaper price than the smaller portion of something that will still fill you up. And I think that's sort of the same way with produce as well, is that when it's picked a day or 2 days before, it's going to have more nutrients in it. It's going to be more satiating than the ones that were picked 2 weeks before and flown and ripened on the cart, but without the actual nutrients being there. Because tomatoes must be picked green if they're being flown from Chile to Washington, D.C. or Baltimore. And so I think those are some important points that, like, while you are paying more money, you're paying for something that is nutritionally more valuable for our population.
Also, too, I think, take your average suburban home, tear up a 20 by 20 plot of the sod in the front of the house, plant yourself a little garden, and when it comes time to picking those tomatoes, you know, tell me how much those tomatoes cost you compared to the mass-produced tomatoes you can buy in the store. Sure, the tomatoes in the store are pretty cheap. The ones that you barely had to do any work for on the land you already owned, those are going to be a lot cheaper. So I think there are plenty of instances where buying local is cheaper, and it really can you really can save money. But I do think you have to be somewhat educated, and so there is some maybe knowledge that goes along that maybe is required.
Now, I'm again one of those who eat our own tomatoes that we grow, and they taste a great deal better than the ones that taste like cardboard you buy in the store, in the large grocery stores. However, having said that, going back to this train of thought for a moment, the majority of people in America at this point in our society are under pretty strict financial limitations. Mm-hmm. The numbers of people who live in official and unofficial poverty in America are huge. Their diets are worse than the rest of the populations because of no access to good food. And the cost of food means a lot. I mean, if you're going to go in and buy a pound of chicken thighs or a package of chicken thighs, what a pound that is, and it costs you $3.19, but you go buy free-range chicken thighs that have no chemicals in them, and it costs you $6 for a package of thighs, well, if you're down on money, you're going to buy the $3 one, not the $6 one, and for almost every item you want to buy. That's what I'm talking about. I'm not saying that there's anything wrong with buying the local and doing those things. I think that's important, and as I said, I'm one of those folks who tries to do that. But I'm also thinking about the larger societal issue we face, which is people can't afford the food we're talking about.
Right.
Are not willing to put that much of their income into it.
I think one of the big things that I'm seeing, at least in multiple cities across the country, is you have small grassroots organizations that are working really hard to do three things for the community. One is to educate, one is to engage, and then the other is to empower. And so and Baltimore is a really great example, for you have Real Food Farm over by Clifton Park, it's a community-based grassroots, like, farm that educates the community about being able to garden, being able to raise your own food. They engage the community that's right there. There are six neighborhoods that, you know, most of them don't have access outside of a convenience store to fresh food, period.
Right.
Whether that's in a grocery store. Right. There's a Johns Hopkins published or had a study over this past year that more than 83% of the population that was surveyed in the five neighborhoods surrounding Clifton Park, and granted, you know, the people who chose to be part of the survey may be a specific, mm-hmm. may not represent the whole,
mm-hmm.
but most of them said that they want, if they had access to fresh food and fresh produce, they would do it.
Absolutely.
And it's, you know, and most of them wanted to spend more time cooking. It was just having those channels of being able to access that food. And so if you have local community members who are starting up smaller farms in those communities and engaging that community to participate in growing its own food, that's empowering the people there to start making a difference without necessarily going out of their way or feeling condescended upon because previously, over, I mean, I'd say 10 years ago, there was a very specific demographic that would be going to farmers markets. You know, and that the cost is sort of a, or that the idea of the cost and the idea of that demographic is, makes people hesitant, I think, to go if they don't fall into that, they don't feel they fall into that category.
But I think we should stick with your chicken thigh example. Let's continue with that one. It's absolutely true. If you go to the store and you go to get the organic grass fed chicken thighs, they're going to be way more expensive. And so wrapped up in this is a required lifestyle change. And maybe that's offensive for people to hear. You know, maybe people are shocked that I should have to change anything about the way I do, the way I eat. I should be able to eat that way no matter what. But my answer. And I kind of learned this when I started eating local food because I didn't really want to spend much more money, is you eat less of the expensive things. And meat is an expensive thing. There was a time not that long ago in society, 50, 70 years ago, when we ate way less meat. And we did that because it was expensive. The only reason we eat the amount of meat we eat now is because it's become so mass-produced that it's cheaper. And so it's true, we eat a lot of meat right now, and to continue that style, that lifestyle, is very difficult without increase. You can't do it on the same cost. And so what I'm saying is, I think you have to change. You have to eat less of that meat. And like I said, some people might be offended to think, well, why should I have to change? It's my right to eat a lot of meat. No, it's not your right at all. We live in a society, society is set up where the things that require the most work and food to get to there, such as animals, are going to be the most expensive. You know, if you have to feed lots of vegetables to a pig to turn it into a pig, well, inherently it's going to be the most expensive thing. And so you can't expect then to eat a big giant pork chop every night of the week. You use meat then more as a condiment or a side dish or a flavoring. You make a stew that has a few pieces of salt pork in it to give it lots of flavor. But the rest of the stew is all kinds of vegetables and potatoes or beans or something like that. And so I think that you can eat locally and not increase your costs at all, but I think you have to change your lifestyle and your diet. And like I said, I don't think that's always easily received by people, but I think it's a requirement.
So kind of bringing us back, in a sense, to what, no pun intended, what feeds this group? Bottom food maker. Boom, pop. I'm very curious how what we've just talked about in terms of the society and the issues that we face in terms of food, how that plays into food makers and what you do with one another. I mean, how you approach food that is different and what attracts people to it.
Sure. So some of the potlucks we've had that have been very interesting. We had one on we have lots of different potlucks, so I'll take a few as examples. One of them last year, which I think we're going to do again very soon, was on pickling and fermenting and kind of canning. And so it was this was last fall, I guess, when we had lots of produce around. It was a good time when you're canning things and putting things away for the winter. We have a potluck. People bring food, and you know, like I said, everyone wants to maybe in a way show off or whatever. So we've had some very interesting things. Lisa, one of the people in the group, brought these fantastic watermelon rind pickles that I've never had. I can't say I've ever eaten watermelon rind before, but that was a perfect example where how many times have you thrown away watermelon rind in your life? And she turned them into something you could eat, and just by pickling them, you know, and kind of fermenting them. And so I think a lot of the food, in many ways, is related to what we were talking about, in that it helps make things go a little further. You know, it helps make things, it's stretching food. You know, it's taking some small amount of food, and you know, maybe you can't eat all the tomatoes that came in your garden this week because it's that week when all the tomatoes get ripe, and by the end of the week, some are going to become rotten. Well, if you make some into sauce and put that in a jar and put that away, you've saved them. You've done more with the food you had. And so I think a lot of the food in the group that's made is in the same vein of preserving it so you can have it later, but also preserving it to make it last, I guess.
What we're doing is cutting up the dried fish peppers.
Yes.
Which are really hot. Local Maryland thing. Mm-hmm. And putting them with the fresh tomatoes, and comes a new kind of salsa. Maryland hot fish pepper red salsa. Anyway,
there
you go. You were going to say, Hillary?
I think one of the big things that we're seeing, at least in food makers and also dealing with this local movement, is it's about being less wasteful. And I think that's a really good example, is that by being conscious of those choices that you make in regards to food, whether you think you're making a more expensive purchase, but then you're going to be less wasteful of it. You're going to really be taking care of the food that you are putting on the table and the food that you do buy. Because, I mean, going back to earlier when we were talking about, you know, there are things that are going to be more expensive if you're buying organic or non-hormone meat.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but then you are really careful that, you know, at the end of a meal, if you still have half that pork chop left, you're going to save it. You're going to be more conscious of those decisions and what you're wasting. And I think that's a really important factor also to the way that our lifestyles are, you know, and something we have to be conscious of is how much we waste and how much we consume and how much we throw away.
Are we going to say something?
I was just going to say, I think a lot of the food preserving techniques came about because there's always an excess of any food at any time of the year that you're growing it. And you have to find some way to put some of that away and save it. So we had another potluck that was all homemade liqueurs and cordials and other little homemade alcoholic drinks. This was one of the more fun ones. And so people had brought all kinds of different little flavor liqueurs. And you might think this is a stretch, like, how does that count as food? But, I mean, at the end of the day, you're putting it in your body. It's got a few calories in it. It's something that, you know, it's something that we ingest. And so it's kind of related. And so it was neat, you know, people going out and learning how do you take some fresh mint from the garden and make creme de menthe with it or something. You know, in the same way, something you might have bought in a bottle off the shelf, learning how you make it. And
I always wanted to try to figure out how to take the juniper berries off the pine tree and make my own gin. That would be there's got to be a way.
Now, I will say officially, we do not do any distilling in the group. That is illegal.
It is illegal, isn't it?
There's home distilling is illegal, so I'm not illegal, condoning though. Home distilling. We're only making liqueurs, which is so hot, for the record.
Legalize it. So tell me, Hillary, I'm curious if the work that you do, is it related to this, to food and the work you do at Baltimore?
Well, one of the things this program is new. We're actually launching this academic year, and it's to help students who at University of Maryland Baltimore are all graduate and professionals.
Right.
So law, dentistry, med school, social work, et cetera. And so it's to help them have more academic life balance and better wellness as they pursue their professional career, so that they can flourish academically as well as personally while they're here with us. So we have five different initiatives, and one of them is called The Hungry Mind, which is why I also talked to Brian about it. But we're working to educate the community in regards to food politics, nutrition, food sustainability, both here locally and then also the culture of food in the United States. So we have things like chef demos, where chefs from local restaurants come in and talk about their own food journeys or give a demo about foods that they serve. We have a food film festival in October where we have films like Food Inc. or Fresh, End of the Line, and we also pair that up with local farmers or local fishermen, local organizations, and mm-hmm. they come in and also do sort of a Q&A post-film discussion. So that connects the students and other members of the community with what's going on, you know, what they just saw, but also that's something here, and that's something that's accessible, and I think that's really important. And so it's really about creating a multi-dimensional and multifaceted view of wellness that's not just physical and mental, but also ethical or cultural or social, financial as well. And so we're, you know, it's a very ambitious project. Again, it's its first year, but I'm really looking forward to the work that we can do in these multiple levels of sort of education.
So in kind of coming back to the food makers, I'm curious where you think this group goes and what it does in this community. I mean, what do you two think about what this group can become and what it is becoming?
I don't think it needs to. I don't think we strive for it to be anything different than it is now, other than being larger. I only mean larger in terms of having more people in it. I think what it's doing right now, which is, you know, having a way for all these people to be connected. In fact, you know, since the Urbanite articles came out, there's been so many people who've joined the group saying, wow, I do all of these things at home too, but I've never known other people who did. You know, I do some canning, or I do a little of this, or I've always wanted to know about this. I've actually been just shocked at how many people in Baltimore are doing what we're doing in the group, and it's just that, you know, we were this little rinky-dink group online, and how else would you find us? And luckily, we have this article about us and the kind of some publicity. But so I guess in terms of where it's going, just having more people involved, because ultimately, I you know, I'll channel Joanna, the founder who started it. She really founded it based on the idea of community, a community around food, that's what I think you inherently need, you know, kind of a critical mass of people to have that community where you have lots of people who can constantly be sharing from each other, trading, teaching each other, learning. And I think we really are. It's been neat as more and more people getting in the group. You know, someone puts a post on there about where can I get, you know, so-and-so. I mean, there was just a post the other night about looking for a local venison source. And, you know, and then all these people who jump on there with, you know, ideas and thoughts and things like that. It's amazing. And then you have someone comes on there and says, I have a brother who's a hunter or something like that. That's just one little example. But there's been so many times where someone has a question about some obscure thing and there's three or four people who know the answer out there. And so I don't feel a need for it to go. I don't feel a need for it to get any more complex. Mm-hmm. Just to continue making that network, building that network of people. That would be fine with me.
I mean, I have to agree. It's hard not to. I mean, I think one of the really important parts, again, and I said this earlier, is this idea of like education, engagement, and empowerment. Is that when you have such a large group of people where you don't feel like you're alone, or if you are, you know, searching for an answer, you don't feel insecure posing that question to a group of people that are very diverse and may have experience or may not, or may also pose, you know, have the same question. And so I think that the growth of this group is something that's really important, because it's more and more like the fingertips are reaching out to more and more people, and more people are getting involved. Or I've had friends who, since I joined, have now started joining, who may not currently be may not have a beehive in their backyard, although that is one of the programs that we have in The Hungry Mind, is how to start your own backyard beekeeping. Uh-huh. But anyway, I digress.
Which we can do in Baltimore.
Yes.
And we can also have chickens in our yards in Baltimore.
Yes. Mm-hmm. No roosters, but you can
have chickens.
You can have chickens.
But, you know, it's people who are starting to realize that there is a practicality to this, that this is something that's not just an idealistic way to live. It's something that is practical and feasible, I think, in our community. And with that large group of people supporting you, that you can make steps, you know, very small steps or very large, to, you know, start being more conscious of the decisions that you make in regard to your food choices.
Do you think things can actually change in a large way to make it smaller?
Brian.
Isn't that the eternal question of every social initiative, of every little thing that you're trying to make change? You know, can you broaden it out to the full society? I don't know. I mean, that's someday, maybe it never becomes more than a, you know, maybe it reaches 10 or 20% of the population, and that's all it ever becomes.
But that's still more than...
It's still worth it.
You know, I'll leave you with this thought. There's a statistic I learned when I did a show with Tony Gerassi a few weeks back. Mm-hmm. And I've been thinking about it a lot, talking to people around the country who are also thinking about the same thing, that if you combined the food acquisition budgets of just the public school systems in the state of Maryland, just the public school systems, all the counties in Baltimore City, it's over $800 million. That if that was changed to buy local for the majority of that money, it could change and alter the nature of agriculture in this state. And almost every state in America is the same way. And that doesn't include Hopkins and Maryland and Baltimore and all the other college institutions that also buy food. I mean, so when I ask that question, I mean, there are things afoot that might even begin to make people think maybe we could transform what we do and how we eat and make it more affordable for the rest of us.
Absolutely. And if, you know, that your statistic there reminds me of what you started out saying at the beginning was, you know, are we too big of a society for local anymore? Do we even have enough room for it, that kind of thing? Imagine if you said, okay, we're going to take all of that money and we're buying it all from local farms in Maryland. And then you said, well, wait a minute. There aren't enough local farms in Maryland. We don't have enough farmland. Well, if you have questions like that staring you in the face and you're looking at things like the Inter-County Connector that's, you know, going to run across over to Rockville. And so you're saying, all right, well, we barely have enough farmland as it is just to feed our schools, and we have a choice now to put in this new highway. I'm not trying to start a whole debate about that, but I guess I'm saying once you're looking at, you know, right, once you're looking at farmland in the context of who it's feeding locally, and do you have enough of it, and can you support just the school systems, let alone the entire city? I think all of a sudden you start making larger choices. And so, you know, that's a perfect example of why just thinking about food and thinking about buying locally can totally change how your society is set up and structured.
Well, it's been just a joy having the two of you here, Brian Murphy and Hillary Edwards. Thank you both so much.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
You've been listening to another one of our Urbanite Radio stories, and you can go to our website and link into this just by going to Urbanite Radio Stories in today's program, or you can go by yourself over to www.foodmake.org and see what Baltimore food makers are up to, and join, get involved, and take Urbanite Radio one step further. Good to have you here. Thank you so much.
Great, thanks.
You're listening to The Mark Steiner Show on Public Radio, WEAA, 88.9 FM. The voice of the community. Don't go away. We'll be right back after this very short break. The Mark Steiner Show is brought to you by Urbanite Magazine's new e-zines, where you can get your weekly fix of arts and culture, food and drink, home and design, style and shopping, and green and sustainable topics. Updated information can be delivered to your inbox. Registration is available at urbanitebaltimore.com.